Hello everyone, welcome back to our virtual ILS Asia 2021 event broadcasts. Please do visit the event website to see the details of our kind sponsors, without who we couldn't put on this event, and you can also view the entire agenda for what's coming up and view any on-demand content from previous sessions there as well. Everything will be archived for your viewing pleasure at a later date. So we're continuing to update you on ILS activity and opportunities with a particular focus on the Asia region. And this year, our theme is expanding market access and opportunities. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Yuko Hoshino, co-head of Global Investor Relations, and also Paul Wilson, head of Non-Life Analytics, who are both from one of the leading ILS asset managers, Securus Investment Partners. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
So for this interview, Yuko, Paul and I are going to discuss investor considerations in the Asia region with a specific reference to Asian peril events and also climate risks. And we're going to discuss an issue that matters to the end investors in ILS particularly, the importance of communications and how analytical research also plays into that. So Yuko, I thought we could begin with you, and perhaps you could give us a bit of background on the Asian ILS investor base and how important education and communication is for your work in the region.
Sure. Majority of investors in Asia are institutional clients, namely pension clients who have allocated around 5 to 10% of their portfolio into ILS over the last 5 to 10 years. Due to some local regulations and difficulties in accessing end investors, we in general very much rely on local fiduciary managers, consultants, placement agents, who are not necessarily an expert in ILS. However, they are able to provide a platform to ILS managers. After the catastrophe events in 2017 and 2018, they have been extremely helpful, not only in helping us to retain investors' base, but also to aid in educating and informing the fine details of CAT events, which are new findings for investors in the financial industry. New findings may include time lag in receiving anticipated losses from reinsurance industry, ILS characteristics of loss creep and side pocket and its cash release schedule, and COVID-19 situation in ILS. But all of them are perhaps anticipated for reinsurance industry, but not for the majority of investors. Through what can only be described as a challenging experience in understanding losses from these events, investors' depth of knowledge increased potentially, exponentially. My geographical investor base are by far the most sophisticated and stimulating through their often detailed and challenging questions about risk modelings and variation and loss reserving concept for their modeling.
Yes, that's encouraging to hear that they're very analytical as well, because it's something I've always felt is incredibly important for the health of the asset class, really, that investors try and get deep into the information. And so, Paul, perhaps we could move over to you, and you lead the analytics function for the non-life investment portfolios at Securus. And how does your team's output play into this investor relations activity?
Sure. I think the first thing I would say is that all the teams at Securus, covering the origination, portfolio management group, all of them play important and complementary roles in supporting our investors and supporting the investor relations functions. And I'm not really sure it's possible to separate the activity in any of those individual functions. They're all quite complementary. However, having said that, having a dedicated team focused on catastrophe models, our use of those models, the vendor selection process, the model evaluations, and the in-house research and development work that my team does, has been really helpful in helping to explain and put in context how our own internal view of risk differs from the sort of market standard view. But perhaps even more generally, that contextual piece is a key sort of value add that I try and bring to the role, especially around, as Yuka said, when events happen, being able to put what's occurring in the context and not just the models which have been used, but also the full historical context has been very important in building confidence with our investors.
That's interesting, Paul. And so your team are furnishing everybody else in the business with information to help them sort of do their jobs better, I assume.
That's exactly how I can describe my team in the role. Is we are there to support the origination function, the portfolio management group, as well as all the investor relations functions. It's really about adding that layer of depth of expertise in natural catastrophe risk.
Mm. And you mentioned your own view of risk as well, which is perhaps something that isn't driven home enough sometimes around ILS, especially with new investors. I think people often feel that the vendor models are maybe seen as the gospel truth, but obviously I assume you go to quite a lot of effort to try and generate your own view and apply your own thinking to the way you manage risk.
Absolutely. We certainly think that the vendor models, they are incredibly powerful tools, but they are very much a starting point in understanding the risk. They have limitations in terms of how they've been developed. Some of those are related to the software platforms they're hosted on. Some of them are related to the frequency of updates. There are also aspects around the models are not complete. They don't attempt to cover all the potential sources of loss. So maintaining your own view of risk is fundamental to accurately pricing investments and managing the risk.
Great. Thank you, Paul. So I thought we could focus perhaps on one of the headline Asian catastrophe events of the last few years that impacted the ILS market. And it was a big hit for the reinsurance market globally as well. Japanese Typhoon Jebi. Yuko, as this event unfolded and beyond, as the loss creep emerged, what sort of questions were you receiving from investors? And I guess how deeply were they trying to get you to furnish them with more information to help them understand this?
Yeah, when Jebi landed almost at Kansai Airport in September 2018, even local people did not expect that it would become the largest loss event in Japanese insurance history. For most Japanese people, as they usually experience many typhoons over summertime, and it's not uncommon to see two typhoons landing somewhere in Japan within a week. Therefore, they did not feel that the initial Jebi loss estimate from the insurance industry was too low. When we started learning an increased loss estimate from our counterparties from end of 2018, we started informing investors that Jebi would create a large degree of uncertainties, which surprised our investors, and they started asking about what's special about Jebi. Jebi loss was more impactful for our aggregate deal, since their loss creep topped over other 2018 events such as Hurricane Michael and wildfires. Contrasted Jebi, my investors were very proactive to large US events, often well in advance to the actual events that were unfolded. Most investors ask us the event impact to the portfolio long before Hurricane landed. So Jebi's case gave our investors a lot of surprises. Their primary question around 2019 were about modeling in Japan typhoon, flood risk, and the methodology of side pocket and how we will reserve losses. So that was their initial reaction.
Interesting. Yeah, it must have come as quite a surprise to yourselves, as I think that the entire industry hadn't expected the creep to emerge in quite the way it did. Pahul, perhaps, obviously you come from the analytical side of things, perhaps you could explain why the loss creep came as such a surprise this time around, and also what you learned from or about the risk models related to this event.
Sure, absolutely. There's been a lot of discussion around Jebi and the way the losses developed from those initial estimates. And I won't try and recap all of that here. You know, we could talk for the entire hour just on that one topic. And I do think it's important to recognize that while obviously you do learn something from every event that occurs, and Jebi is no exception in that case, we've learned a lot about the interaction of wind field and urban environments from that kind of storm. But to my mind, the real issue with Jebi and what occurred back in 2018 was the sort of quality and the poor quality of the initial estimates that were received from the model vendors that they were put out in the market, and perhaps an over-reliance of the market on those initial model estimates. Not actually an issue, a fundamental issue, with the models themselves. Now, when I talk to our investors, I always try and separate the two aspects of the use of the catastrophe models. There is the sort of the use of the catastrophe model as a tool to price investment, using the stochastic event catalogs and the thousands of simulations of sort of pseudo events that could potentially occur in the future. And then there's a separate tool, which is used to using that model framework, using input which has been derived from observations of events that are occurring in real time, to calculate the damages of a storm as it is occurring in real time. So a good model with an accurate and robust view of risk can still produce a bad real-time estimate for many, many different reasons. You know, I know switching away from Asia, but I remember looking at Irma in 2017, and there was a large power failure in the southeastern part of Florida, which meant that many of the meteorological observations which were being passed into these systems were delayed in their access, or they were not available at the time. So there was a big data gap in that southeast quadrant of Florida. And that kind of issue can translate into very poor estimates of the initial losses. So that separation of the nature of these tools is very important to recognize and to communicate to our investors. When Jebi occurred in 2018, you could probably argue that Japan was probably one of the most well-modeled peak power regions in the world in terms of the completeness and sophistication of the models available. And while some of the latest models were not being well used by the market at that point, largely due to software issues, firms like ours have taken the step to try and overcome some of the issues and make sure that we're integrating the latest model and latest thinking in our own view of risk, making sure that that's as comprehensive as possible. But I do think as well with Jebi, it's important to recognize that, you know, as with the US in 2017 and Javier Maria, Jebi and in 2018 and even the 2019 events were following on from a period of fairly low activity, with perhaps only a handful of moderate events over the last decade, right? That broke in 2011, there was Shenzhen in 2006. So you had to go back to about 2004 between that very active season in Japan before you have any real sort of comparable level of loss experience. And that predates many ILS managers itself. This lack of recent experience has lots of implications. The benchmarks people are using to reference the occurrence of storm are probably less recent. And folks, you know, the people working in the field are probably less familiar with some of the public data assets, things like the come out of the Fire Disaster Management Agency in Japan or the GIHA in Japan. And that sort of that experience does have a lot of implication in terms of how battle-hardened these teams are to respond to these events. So this loss experience we've had over the last few years does have some positive aspects in terms of, you know, events which will be occurring in the future. The teams are just going to be much more robust to understand the implications of storms that are happening.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's perhaps by these events occurring, it gives the industry a chance to catch up and improve its processes and underwriting around Japan. Bit of learning on the job, unfortunately, which is a challenging place at the time it happens, but hopefully puts you in a better position going forwards. And perhaps, Paul, staying with you, I mean, how much more confident are you now about loss creep from similar events, and whether we'll see another Jebi moving that much? And what have you been doing to adjust the sort of the processes at Securis to help you respond to these types of Japanese typhoons and similar losses?
It's a good question. And one of the remits of my team is to establish an independent view of the scale of the industry losses as they occur for all major catastrophe events. And that's constructed independently of any information we've seen from counterparties or cedents. It's constructed independently from the work, the valuation, the reserving team have done. It's constructed independently from the origination, the portfolio management groups. So it's then fed in as a benchmark, which all of those teams work and can peg around and level set against. I'm a scientist, so I approach that problem as a scientist, you know, collect as many data points as possible, make hypotheses and test those hypotheses, And most fundamentally, remain skeptical at all points in time. So you're really challenging the information that's coming through from multiple different data sources and multiple different points of view to really see that all of this is making sense. I report directly to the evaluation committee, so that independent scientific perspective is at the heart of our process. And we believe that it's critical to ensuring the robustness of our process. However, I should probably also acknowledge that the data and modeling landscape in Japan and Asia in general has changed significantly since 2018. We now have both PCS and the new Presto Click service reporting on the scale of industry losses, so that's extra data points, which didn't exist back in 2018. But we also have greater model coverage, you know, people like the likes of Karen Clark and Co. releasing their Japan typing models. And so you have more independent model estimates becoming available to reference against. But also, you have tools like the automated event response service, which Aon have developed for Europe and for the US. I understand that probably next year that will become available for Japan as well. So, and I hope Adam and his team won't mind me advertising the work of their team. But those kind of tools, which have existed for a long time for other regions of the world, are now available for Japan as well. So we will have a much more robust process in place. At least the tools to have a much more robust process in place are now available. But perhaps the thing I should maybe stress as well, I would never want to underestimate the importance of having that sort of local expertise. Knowing that I can rely upon Yuko and the team based out of Tokyo to help me understand the local information, even if that's just translating information which is only available in Japanese, that's incredibly important. I've supported event response and loss response activity, first at RMS and then now at Securus for over a decade. And in my experience, you should never underestimate the importance of that local context and that local expertise when trying to understand the events which are occurring.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Having and particularly in countries where language can be a barrier as well, it must be valuable having people on the ground. I guess one final point on that, Paul, for you. Do you think the underwriting submission data has perhaps improved a little bit since 2018? Because I had heard at the time that some companies were finding the submission information a little lacking in some cases on reinsurance deals.
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to speak to that, but I can absolutely say that, you know, from the conversation I've had, yes, we have found it's improved. We are certainly we have higher expectations on the submission data we receive, and we are being more critical of it as well. So that's something that's certainly improved in our underwriting process as well.
Yeah, great. No, I think there's hopefully a change running through the industry, I think, where some of these losses of recent years all over the world have driven a few surprises, and people are now asking for that additional level of data to help them underwrite more accurately in the first place, which is positive for the industry. Now, Yuko, moving back to you, and we'll stick on maybe Jebi or the related seasons as well. And they provided a good example of a catastrophe event that we may have assumed was really well modelled, but turned out to be loaded with surprises for the industry. But what was the main sort of messages you were delivering to your investors at Securus after these sort of challenging loss years?
Along with a hardening market and an increase in risk-adjusted returns, portfolio managers reduced exposure to aggregated layers, attritional losses through quota shares, and high-risk investments. The impact of the 2019 Japan typhoons, backside hagibis, were reduced, and we were able to demonstrate that with portfolio shift could reduce the magnitude of losses.
And the investors understand those shifts in portfolio sort of with your help. What kind of questions do you get about when you explain that you're changing underwriting strategy slightly in response to prior experience?
I guess that investors are positively surprised by the difference between how the portfolio impacted by Jebi versus Faxai and Hagibis, because both Faxai Hagibis were quite strong typhoons as well in the aggregate level. So I think investors do appreciate the portfolio shift to less exposure to aggregate layers or less exposure to quota shares. That definitely sort of demonstrating the risk, the tail risk being reduced.
And obviously in a market that's firming, as we've seen the last year or so, that's exactly the right time to be making those sorts of changes. Paul, perhaps we could shift back to you and talk about the other major peril in the Japanese region, which is obviously earthquakes, one of the biggest peril threats in the world, really, to the reinsurance and the ILS market as well, and a lot of ILS capital deployed to that risk. But do you anticipate similar issues, including loss creep, could emerge there after the next major event? I know we've seen this, the February quake off the coast of Fukushima has seen its loss gradually increasing over the last few months. Do you think that's perhaps something the ILS market needs to watch out for?
Absolutely, and I was going to thinking of mentioning that very event as you were speaking. I am very confident in our process, but I'm sorry to say that we absolutely can't be complacent about earthquake risk around the world. There are very good public data sources and public information around earthquake risk and in real time following events. But we've seen a lot of press so far this year around the 10th anniversary of the Tohoku event. But as you say, the magnitude 7 Fukushima event, which we saw in February, the initial model loss estimates for that event were less than $500 million across most of the vendors. And we're now seeing estimates from DCS have declared this event as being meeting their $2 billion threshold. Cresta Clicks are referencing a number in excess of $2 billion as the industry estimate for this event. But we're certainly seeing something that's concerning there and something that does need to have quite a lot of attention to it. But even beyond this, earthquake risk and the communication following a major earthquake event is quite an interesting problem, an interesting challenge around ethical process. When a typhoon occurs, you may learn something about your understanding of the risk from that event, but it doesn't actually fundamentally change the underlying true risk of next season's events. When an earthquake occurs, there are physical processes, stress transfer, which can change the risk for the region, in a physical way. And let's not forget that the Christchurch event from 2011 was part of a sequence of events which started with the Dartford event in 2010. We've actually been working with Ross Stein and his team at Temblor on, integrating the work they've been doing, which allows us to make adjustments to our view of risk very rapidly following on from major events. And this is something that we want to be able to promote and utilize that expertise when communicating with our investors. Ross and his team are obviously fantastic about communicating these very complicated ideas very clearly, and that's something that we look to leverage when we communicate these things with our investors.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned Temblor. They're a company I've seen some data from in the recent months, and they do seem to be providing a different type of information that perhaps hasn't always been factored into underwriting in that way, that that there are effects from events which could influence future events as well.
That process has been built into many models previously, but it is that ability to access that information very rapidly following events, which is one of the real value add they bring to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. Much, much quicker than the traditional sort of model update cycle would be. And Yuko, perhaps moving back to you and the investor relations work at Securis. When Paul and the R&D team come up with something new in terms of research or look at a new product or a new data source, and if that's going to adjust the view of risk at Securis, how do you communicate that to investors? How do you ensure you're keeping them up to date on the latest information like that?
We have received a material increase in number of questions from investors, which relates to less developed risk modeling, as well as Securis' in-house view of risk to learn how we upgraded and how we updated our modeling during the subsequent renewal seasons. Paul has been instrumental to field any questions related to loss update modeling and how we continue to develop the Securis in-house view of risk in an environment of relatively increased frequencies of US hurricane and how the underwriters further adjust the models. Additionally, Paul, along with many of key members of the investment teams, are very helpful with communicating these developments to our investors.
And do you showcase sort of bits of technology to them, perhaps, when you produce something that's going to be a new tool that's used at Securus?
Not in the great details, but we definitely ask Paul in many ways to walk my investors through that any sort of upgrade or any sort of sophisticated modification we have made in our house view.
Yeah, no, well, it's critical to keep them updated on that sort of thing. Now, let's move on from sort of the regional and global peak catastrophe perils we've just been discussing and discuss a really hot topic among investors, which is climate risk. Now, Yuko, perhaps we'll stick with you and maybe you could give us an overview of some of the questions you're hearing and the concerns you're hearing in relation to climate change and climate risk at this point in time.
Yeah, we tend to be asked many questions about global warming and climate change, how these may impact to our investments and to ESG concept almost every week or maybe every other day. When we answer these questions, we need to articulate that our climate risk analysis is applicable over 1 year period and not necessarily for a long-term horizon. But I will actually pass to Paul for the more scientific explanation behind.
Sure. Paul, maybe you could sort of explain for our audience sort of how you distinguish between climate risk and climate change and how you'd explain that to an investor.
Sure, happy to. As you just mentioned, whenever I ask to talk about climate change and its significance to the ILS market, the two things I always stress are really important to understand timescales and the baseline of the risk. You know, for the most part, like you mentioned, our investments are limited to a few years. And for our investors, the critical question has to be, has the impact of climate change on the risk of extreme weather on the timescale of the investment being considered in your pricing risk management processes? And that's a very different question to other asset classes and some of the regulatory stress tests that have been that insurance companies are being asked to perform right now, where the timescale is typically much longer. But when we focus on that 1 to 3 year timescale, you know, what you need to then do is explain precisely what baseline you're using for your own internal view of risk and how that has been constructed and evaluated. Now, I can't obviously disclose all the details, but I can happily say that for multiple perils and regions, our internal view of risk is significantly elevated compared to the climatological baselines, which are still being passed around the market by counterparties. And that's not just with respect to the sort of average frequency of events, but it also plays into the overall volatility you can expect from that activity. Now, we have seen very recent periods of very quiet activity in the last 10, 15 years. The famous hurricane drought of no major hurricane landfall between 2006 and 2016. Both sides of that coin need to be factored in if you're thinking about your view of risk. And so that in part is the recognition of natural variability, but it also reflects the potential impact of climate change. So when I'm talking to investors, I always stress, especially when looking at some of the headline-grabbing statements about climate change, you need to put those statements in the context of your current baseline, which may already be higher. Now, none of that is to dismiss the importance of understanding the future potential impacts that climate change may have on these risks. But there's little point worrying about the future if you're not pricing today's risk accurately in the first place and managing that risk responsibly.
Yeah, that's actually a really strong, good message as well, Paul, the fact that you need to baseline it today, don't you, and price for what you can see and expect with your view of risk, and then consider trends depending on the duration of the investments you're making as well. Just a quick one for you, Yuko. Do you think that the Asian investor base are more or less focused on climate than investors in perhaps US and Europe? Or is, because I know ESG is a very hot topic in Japan right now. Do you think there's a particular climate focus there?
Well, I have hearing a lot of interest from our investor base in Japan to ask about climate change and also, our ESG philosophy to it. And perhaps that, as Paul said, that people are actually asking, but not really sort of understanding the differentiation between the two Paul just mentioned. So that we're dealing with climate risk, but not climate change risk. So I am quite busy explaining the difference between the two. And but the ESG is very, very hot topic, as you just mentioned, in Japan.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Paul, what sort of specific research and work does your team undertake to try and get to grips with climate-related factors and ensure that you have the best view of that as it develops and as trends change?
Well, the first thing I say is we've actually just expanded our team to bring in more expertise on climate. So making sure that you have the right in-house expertise and the right skills in the organization is obviously something that's pretty critical. The importance here is to make sure that you're engaged with the scientific community, with the literature, so that you can evaluate the potential impacts of climate change when it's part of the basics of your sort of model evaluation adoption process. You know, the techniques to adjust catastrophe models for, you know, an elevated view of risk aren't new. You know, the core model vendors introduced these approaches and techniques back in 2005, 2006, when they introduced the concept such as warm SST catalogs or medium-term rate views of risk. You know, the tools and techniques have been used in academic literature as well, in academic publications, some of which I've been, you know, fortunate enough to work on. So the tools and approaches to adjust models for climate change are well established, and it's simply a matter of applying them very, very carefully, which is what our team strive to do. And the key here is working with the right partners. You know, you can't do this kind of work if the models you're using aren't open and transparent enough to allow you access to the underlying information you need to make the correct adjustments in models. You know, the right partners are key here. Closed off models serve absolutely no one well. And that openness and transparency is something that we are, it is one of the critical requirements in our vendor selection and our process of working with partners.
Interesting. Do you think that as your understanding of climate as a risk or the trend around climate risk evolve, do you think the ILS industry could end up providing longer tenure transactions? I know there are some deals that go out sort of 3 to 5 years, but it seems that the world is almost clamoring for risk capital that's willing to put itself on risk for longer than that now. I wonder whether you think perhaps that's in the ILS market's future.
I think what I can answer that is that from an analytical perspective, I would be absolutely comfortable using the tools we have, linking them together with the scientific information which is available, and that there is a wealth of data information there to provide those sort of tools. I would be very comfortable working with the underwriters and the risk management function of Insurus to look at those kind of transactions, because I do believe we have the tools and technology to price those investments accurately.
Yeah, no, that's encouraging, because I do think there's going to be demand for this sort of thing over the coming years, particularly around as disclosure becomes something that's mandated. People are going to look for how they can hedge that risk that they're bearing in their assets and portfolios. Thank you, Paul. So moving back to you, Yuko, we've discussed quite a lot of the technical sort of risk specific issues that are on ILS investors' minds at the moment. But what else is going to be a hot topic, do you think, over the next few years for investors? And how are you helping to equip your investors to understand emerging issues?
Well, I guess that going back to ESG, many investors are aware that ESG is one of the hot topics within financial market, and they continue to ask us in more frequent basis than over the last 2-3 years about ESG policy and about our future stance towards ESG. We have signed UNPRI in 2017, and we have been very carefully monitoring our investments via ESG elements. I think we should be proud that ILS is providing a strong analytical spec towards E element, and no other industry can assess the risk of climate risk as we in the ILS industry do. In addition, no investor doubts ILS contribution to S element, and Z is almost a given if we diligently conduct counterparty review and documentation check. Separate to ESG, I think going back to the sort of financial market and conditions and how that would influence investors' way of thinking, I think future market conditions should bring ILS to forefront of investors' mind, given the unprecedented level of expenditure as a result of COVID-19 and significant fragility of economic environment, coupled with ever expanding and realistic equity valuation, I believe that we will see an increased level of investors' appetite in ILS. That's my view.
Yes, I was actually going to ask you that. Do you think that sort of the low interest rate environment that we see at the moment and now the additional heightened risk perception that we seem to see around the world after COVID, that's all going to help to drive investors towards an asset class like this, I would imagine?
Yeah, that's how I believe so.
Great. Thank you, Yuko. So look, I'd like to thank you both for participating and for sharing your insights with us today. I think our audience will find that very interesting. So thank you, Paul. Thank you, Yuko. I wish you both well and hope to catch up with you in person at some point in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.